Good Morning New Hampshire, powered by Sig Sauer. Now, back to Jack Heath on the Pulse of New Hampshire.
All right, welcome back. And remembering Joe Lieberman, we're going to have a great New Hampshire story in a moment. Renee Palmer, but first, John Decker, our own White House correspondent. Good morning, John.
Hey, good morning to you, Jack. Let me just lend my voice to the tributes that you may be making to the former senator from Connecticut. Really, you don't see many Democrats at all like Joe Lieberman these days. I don't think he would recognize the party that he was at the national ticket of back in 2000. It's changed quite a bit. And the great thing about Joe Lieberman, I always thought, is that when he said something, you knew he believed what he said. He didn't put his finger up, you know, see which way the wind was blowing. He really said what he believed, and you don't see politicians like that anymore either.
Well, how about this? He was in politics, but he was not a politician. I mean, he was a politician in terms of he was effective and talented, got on a national ticket and all that, but he was just a gentleman. He was a nice person, and not just would he not recognize the Democrat Party, I don't think he'd recognize politics today.
Right. A public servant in the truest sense of that word. Right. 6 years as Attorney General for Connecticut, 20 years representing the state in the U.S. Senate. You know, he will be missed. It's unfortunate that accident took his life.
Yeah, principles. All right, what else, John, on this Thursday morning?
Big fundraiser in New York City today, Radio City Music Hall for the Biden campaign. It will raise an expected $10 million. That is one race in which Joe Biden is certainly leading Donald Trump. That's the race for campaign cash. $71 million cash on hand at the beginning of March, the beginning of this month. That compares with less than half of that for the Trump campaign. Of course, he's using a lot of that campaign cash to pay off legal bills. So this is a big moment today for the Biden campaign in terms of adding to their campaign war chest.
Yeah, I bet you they'll raise more than that. All right, John Decker, our own White House correspondent. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Jack.
All right. As I said, Renee Palmer on the Seacoast side of things, and just a calendar reminder, May 15th, we go 12 hours for Veterans Count. Make 12 hours count for Veterans Count. 12 hours commercial free. And, of course, the first call I made more than 10 years ago was to Renee to get this going, and hopefully she can help us out some that morning. But she's not calling in about that. If anyone understands reaching across the aisle and understanding decency in public policy, it is Renee Palmer with a memory and a thought of Joe Lieberman.
Hi, how are you?
You don't care.
No, I don't. But let me tell you about Senator Joe Lieberman. So, you know, years ago when I was involved with John Broderick with the No Labels, the first convention was here in New Hampshire. And Joe Lieberman and John Huntsman were up here because they were very involved in this movement. And actually, we were in your studios, and John and Governor Huntsman and Senator Lieberman were being interviewed. So John Broderick and I, we had lunch with them. We were at the back room at the Puritan.
Oh yeah, classic.
And then we were just driving around, and it was Broderick, me, Lieberman, and Huntsman in the back of my car.
Yeah.
And it was just so classic. Now I wish I had like a recording of just what was going on. We had so much fun. He was sweet, Jack.
Yeah, there were amazing people that came through New Hampshire at that time. And you just made me think of one great warm memory when you're talking about being in the back seat and just laughing and going to the back room. I remember when the late Peter Jennings came to WMUR, and we're in the new building, the primary. He's up there with, remember, Cokie Roberts, who passed away?
Oh, yeah.
And what a class team. And my oldest daughter was young at the time, and my smarter, prettier, better half had dropped her off because I was, like, living at the station before the primary. I was in there from, like, 6 in the morning till 10 at night. So I had to go down to the production room for something, and she's in my office playing at the desk with a toy, and Peter Jennings is sitting there across the way in a cubicle getting ready for the World News Tonight out of our studios, and he comes in and he goes, Jack, I'll watch her.
What?
Yeah. I go, what? He goes, yeah, it's like 4 o'clock, 4:15. He's, I got time till 6:30 or 7. I'll play with her. And Peter Jennings is over there. And then I remember Bill Clinton, he's running for president, speaking of these times.
Yeah.
And he comes into our newsroom, and Jennifer Crompton, and we're all getting ready for the news. And he sits down. He goes, "So how do you put together newscasts?" I said, "Governor, why don't you sit down and join us?" So he, you know, he's sitting down, he's watching. And again, my smarter, prettier, better half brought one of the, you know, brought my daughter by, and so Clinton's sitting there at the table, and you know she's sitting there, and my and you know who my right. my yeah. other half is sitting there. And he's just shooting the bull with us, like, you know, sitting there at the table asking her about her daycare. And, you know, the times were, they were different in that you had the people like Bob Dole, who you know, you knew well.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Democrats, Republicans. But there was a civility. There was even politics is always it goes. If he goes back to, you know, you can go back to founding fathers in their feuds. I mean, you know, Jefferson, right. Adams, but nothing. There was a civility.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know what? What you were describing, what I'm describing, being with Huntsman, Broderick, and Lieberman, is just the magic of New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And people do not understand that. You know, it's when they hear stories like what you're talking about and what I remember that you just think, this is so classic. This is so classic New Hampshire. And I guess this is another reason why we need to go ahead and stay in politics in the first in the nation.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, that's why I made such a big racket when the Democrats of all parties, I'm sorry, I'm going to say it, but I'm going to be civil, take away our primary on the calendar. Yeah. They want to anoint their candidates, and yet they're the party that talk about elections and free and open and easier voting, and then they don't want their own to vote for their nominee. They want to muscle the process like, you know, Chicago mob. And I'm like, but anyway. And the other thing is, we need to understand that there is still a decency. And look at, you want to know what's wrong with the country. Look at New Hampshire and Concord. You still, even though there's more divisiveness than ever, a senator, I can have Dallas Sandra on my show on a Friday with Jeb Bradley, two different parties, and they praise each other.
Yeah.
Even though they don't agree and they voted differently on sanctuary cities, you got Dallas Sandra on my show calling the Senate president Jeb Bradley. His first name's Jeb, of course, the Jebster, good friend of mine. We don't see eye to eye on this, but you know what I'm saying? That's the difference.
Difference. Well, this is, you know, people need to bring their young kids. It's what's happening at home at the dinner table, if they're sitting at the dinner table, and to look at this, learn from actions, not from what words, but watch. You know, you hope that eventually these kids will see this and think, wait, why are they getting along? Yeah. And even the parents, some of these parents need to have a couple of lessons in civility.
Not just some. I mean, when I talk to, I'm sorry to get down on this, but I talk to a lot of the folks on a lot of different social, like mental health fronts. They say, you know what? Parents have to get into their kids' life at a younger age. Don't worry about upsetting them if you have to take away their cell phone. You know, you can ask where they're going at night. Need to get in their face and raise them. And it's not a democracy. I used to say that in our household. I mean, I'm not there to be liked every day, but sometimes I'm going to make a decision to protect my, like Mother Nature, a mother bear, a father bear. You protect your cubs. Anyway.
And one of the things, Jack, the parents need to raise their kids. Don't ask the teachers.
I know.
The teachers are not there to raise your kids.
I know. And we wonder why they're...
Get into your house and be a parent, for God's sakes.
Well, wait a minute. I want you to elaborate on this for a minute, too, because you were talking about this at a local level. And that's no wonder why people don't want to become teachers. Take a moment on this subject.
Well, because, you know, I'm hearing this from people that I know, especially when you have these areas where, you know, the parents are a little bit too busy running their own lives. You have these children, you raise them at home. And so when the teachers grab them, when you have these kids that are going to school, all right, they're there to teach. They're not there to parent. That happens at home. So when you have these teachers calling you up and telling you that little Susie or little Mikey is disrupting the class, don't you point at the at the teachers. You better point at yourself. And I think what's happening is the Board of Education should be ashamed of themselves about their way that they're allowing this.
And parents, well, if your kid comes home and gets a C+ or not a good exam, don't go yell at the teacher.
They deserve the C+.
You know
not
what?
Not everybody can be smart.
Well, you know what? Smart's a subjective term, but you know what? When we were younger, I remember it was called tough love. And I remember in Swampscott, it's just funny. I got a buddy in Swampscott, Kenny Pearl, will listen to the show, and he'll remember this. If I got into an after-school scuffle or fight with some buddies, you know, some other friends, maybe yeah. maybe a hockey game, and afterwards we decide to take it outside, and I come home with a black eye, or a cut. No, when I was younger, or my friend. So one time I come home and my late father who passed when I was young is waiting with me in the living room with my mother. I walk in, it's about 5:30, 5 o'clock. I got a little bruise. we heard from Kenny Bloom's parents that you and your friends, you got in a fight, and he's got a pretty bad black eye. So we want you to get your butt, although they use a different term, over there, knock on the door and apologize. Then you come back up, go in your room, don't say a damn word, get up in the morning, go to school, and this is what you're going to do differently this week. And there was no comeback. You couldn't blame anyone. It wasn't my fault. Whatever. But again, today they'd call that abuse. Someone would call that abuse.
I'm telling you, you know what? If people don't get serious about this, people are going to start crying.
Oh, my God. And get out the bubble wrap for the holidays. And then, of course, Dick Fuller, Swampscott, Boston College hockey coach, he took us to Canada. He took us all over Boston. We did great. If you were selfish or stupid on the rink with the puck and you weren't listening to him, he would grab your shirt, pull it right up against his chin, like lift you off the ice because he played college hockey and we were, 14. Imagine a parent seeing that today. You grab my child. He'd be thrown in the gulag. And you know what we learned? Respect. I would take a bullet for him later in life because he was such a good coach. Taught me more about life than hockey. Yeah. But he would grab us. Today you can't touch. You can't grab a kid. Are you kidding me? Oh, my God. All right, listen, you got me going.
On this Holy Thursday, let me just calm down, okay?
Oh, thank you. I forgot. How could I forget? Thank you.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm sure that will offend someone. All right.
have a good Easter, Jack.
And I don't give a darn. Thank you. Happy Easter. Happy Easter. Happy Mother's Day. Happy Father's Day. Happy Easter.
Merry Christmas.
I'll even throw in St. Patrick's Day. That will offend someone. Michael Dennehy, Dennehy Boulay Group, one of the political great ones, analyst-wise and strategist advisor, joining us. And Michael, Renee Plummer got me going there. Can I say Holy Thursday without offending anyone?
Well, Jack, can I say bloodbath without offending anyone?
Can I say Happy Mother's Day, Happy Father's Day? Can I say can I say Happy St. Patrick's Day? I mean, bring out the bubble wrap. Wow.
It's awful.
I think a great side business for you and me might be to launch a political bubble wrap line for Christmas. Just like bubble wrap. I'd start with Princeton, Columbia, Harvard. Send the bubble wrap for the incoming freshman.
Honestly, it's so out of control. It really is.
And then I said ballots to the political science department saying, instead of like running for office while you're teaching, why don't you put your name on a ballot?
Seriously. I know.
Hey, Michael, a lot to talk about, but J-Dog was remembering earlier at the top of the show and the late Senator Lieberman now, some memories with John McCain, who's also passed, but someone you knew well. Just your thoughts on Lieberman's place in American political history.
Well, one of a kind, honestly. Honestly and truly, he just, kind of like John McCain, but even more so, I think, Joe Lieberman just represented someone that you don't see in politics today anymore. As gracious and kind as a human being can be, obviously on the ticket, national ticket, almost became like inches away from becoming Vice President of the United States. Ran on his own right 4 years later, and then switched to independent, supported John McCain as the Republican nominee for president. I mean, this guy, he just epitomizes everything that's good about politics. It's pretty amazing. He came up, and I campaigned with him when he was up here doing work for John McCain in 2008, and he was such a nice guy and fun to be around.
Always had a nice smile and grin. I bet you he called you Michael, not Mike. I guarantee it was, hey, Michael.
Without a doubt. That's exactly.
Very formal. Formal, full first name.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, really, listen, let's switch gears. I bet your cell phone was lit up yesterday after the news in the morning we had. Ann Custer calling it quit, second district. A lot of people did not see that coming. Names I've been hearing on the Democrat side, Colin Van Ostern already probably getting that runway set. Maybe that was the plan, but he'll be formidable in that district. Our own Dr. Vikram Mancharamani, I think, was making some calls. We had Lily Tang Williams on the show yesterday. She's already in. What names? I didn't ask Renee Plummer if she's running. I'm not asking Mike Dennehy if he's running. But what names are you hearing?
Yeah, I'm hearing those names, Jack. Andrew Belinsky is making moves toward running as well on the Democratic side, and Bob Burns on the Republican side. And I think it'll be another wild open seat race. And you know, it's a fascinating district. It really is when you look at the numbers. I don't think many people remember that Donald Trump only lost the second congressional district by 1.7 points in 2016. It's pretty amazing. That's how close he came to winning the second congressional district. And so, you know, Republicans always believe there's a chance with the right political environment and the right candidate. And the question is, can those two things align? And 2 years ago, George Hansel, a lot of the establishment got behind him. But Lily Tang Williams, she got over 20% of the vote. And then Bob Burns got 33% of the vote and edged out George Hansel. It does appear as though we're headed in that same kind of direction on the Republican side. So Dr. Vic maybe would be replacing George Hansel. But if Bob Burns and Lily Tang Williams are in there, it's just hard to say how it all shakes out.
And is it winnable for a Republican, Michael, that district?
That's right. If Donald Trump can get as close as he did in 2016, yes. The short answer is yes. But that's a big if. I don't know if he can get as close as he did in 2016. I don't think he'll lose as badly as he did in 2020. But if Colin Van Ostern is the Democratic nominee, he is formidable. He only lost to Chris Sununu by 2 points. So it's going to be a tough race for the Republicans. And the Democrats, I might add, are going to spend through the nose. Much Republicans, I don't think, will even put it on their list. But the Democrats are going to fight tooth and nail to keep that seat.
Interesting. And, you know, again, I think Cindy Warmington was someone on the Democrat side who probably would have loved to have run for that, not knowing it would open up. Mike, you, again, you've spent a lot of time in the Capitol and Concord, probably pretty much your adult life. Still live in the area, as far as I know. The only thing that's different is you have a horse. You should, by the way, have you ever thought of riding your horse at the State House?
My horse is under the weather again, so
I'm sorry.
I wouldn't dare even attempt it.
No, I hope you. But listen, seriously, I remember Ann Custer's mom, Susan McClain, the state senator, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
And certainly Ann Custer, very formidable. You have to give her kudos for, since I think she succeeded Charlie Bass, and almost unbeatable in that district. Why do you think she's not running again? Just had enough, doesn't like the environment, just point of life, personal, not my business kind of thing. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I have to believe Annie Custer is one of those very rare politicians who actually has decided she wants to enjoy retirement. Most of them don't leave. Certainly they don't leave early enough, but that's what it seems like. It seems like she wants to spend time with her family, and that's certainly admirable. No one should be there for more than 10 or 12 years, and that's how long she's been there.
Don't get me going.
I know. Yeah, but that's what all signs point to. It does seem to be sudden. But, you know, these things shouldn't – I don't think she should have announced last year that it was going to be her last year because, she meant to keep the things going.
But she might not have known. I mean, we all make decisions
Absolutely.
In life, day to day, week to week, month to month. All right, one of the great ones, Michael Dennehy, Dennehy Boulay Group. Thank you, Michael.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Jack.
Aaron Rial, ABC News Radio national correspondent, with an update on the now infamous or famous bridge collapse.
Yes, that's right, Jack. And I'm glad that you bring up, you know, the ports around your area, because one of the fascinating things about this, obviously you look at it and you're like, oh boy, there's going to be costs associated with this for sure. But overall, logistics experts say that the broader economic impact is going to be limited for the simple reason that you just described. There's a large number of alternative highways and seaports up and down the eastern seaboard. Already ships that were supposed to go to Baltimore are being diverted to Newark or Virginia or Savannah. There's many. And while this will be absolutely a regional profound loss for the economy. Baltimore is going to suffer. Listen, the port directly employs 15,000 workers. Many are going to be furloughed. There's also another 140,000 jobs that are supported indirectly by this port. It's going to be an issue for Baltimore. We also know that there's now toxic chemicals leaking off of this. Maryland is known for its crab. It's going to have an environmental impact. It's going to really hurt the seafood. It's going to be a problem for Baltimore.
It was a big accident. Yeah, it's a big, big accident. Not small at all.
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, Baltimore apparently only handled about 3% of all East Coast and Gulf Coast imports. It was crucial for cars and light trucks. Benz, Volkswagen, BMW, they all had operating facilities. But the type of, you know, cycle through this economy is going to only be a couple weeks, believe it or not. And many economists think that overall the disruption is not even going to be noticeable by late April, given where it happened and it's and our ability to move
things
around.
Which is amazing. Aaron Rial, NBC News Radio national correspondent. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, I want to bring in Matt Mayberry, just a great person out there, been a while and does so much on the home builder side, development side, and supporting veterans. Matt called something to my attention, and I have to be candid, I don't know a whole heck of a lot about it, so me being maybe not the fastest boat in the river, but not the slowest, I said, why don't I have Matt on to explain about it, talk about this, and it's called, under the new green, the so-called Green New Deal. I talked about how Vermont now wants to raise their income tax for a higher level to 11.75%, but it could add a lot of money onto the price of a new home. Take it away, Matt.
Absolutely, Jack. Good morning. And you're not the slowest boat because you're a speedboat. You race down and you're good to go, so thank you. I want to come on and talk with you a little bit about this green energy tax that the legislature is voting on today. It's House Bill 1059, and our friends on the far left are introducing an amendment to bring us to the 2021 energy codes. That sounds pretty benign, but what it does, Jack, is the enactment of that 2021 energy code would add between $15,000 and up to $90,000 per home new construction here in New Hampshire. Wow. We had over 5,000 building permits pulled last year. Imagine if we had to tack on another $25,000, $30,000 on top of this. They want exciting things like if you're with your family watching TV, if you don't move within 5 to 7 minutes, the lights go out, automatic shutoffs. If you leave the light on for your kids at night, it's good for like 5 to 7 minutes, then it shuts off.
I love to cook. What about my gas stove? Are they going to take that away from me, Matt?
Oh, that's gone. That's gone. That's an antique.
No. Good luck with that. Good luck with that.
Exactly. It's this radical kind of, you know, they want to social image the whole thing. They want to do, you know, societal benefits.
So what's the result? Where's this at? Is it real? Is it there? Is it done? What?
It's very real. An amendment is coming up today to change from the 2018 to the 2021 energy codes. And we're imploring state representatives, please vote no on the 2021 energy tax.
It's voting today?
They're voting today. They're voting this afternoon.
It still has to go through the Senate?
Then we'll go to the Senate after that. Hopefully we can kill this in the House to save homebuyers up to $30,000, roughly, on their home. And we call it a green energy tax because it's a mandate from the federal government. We believe that consumers should have the option. Families know best. You know what's best for you and your family's budget versus, you know, the Green New Deal saying, no, we must save the planet by making you pay $50,000.
You know, Matt, I'm going to take a moment on this because I think of my brother-in-law, and I won't say where in Maine, but up in northern Maine, they put a windmill farm up there. And, you know, I love green stuff, by the way, and I love solar and smart stuff. But instead of letting the market work it out, this was oversubsidized. You know what happened? These are the windmills that are like, they look like they're from another planet, out of space, huge. It was a scam. The companies took the subsidies, which is taxed to stimulate this. And when they break down, they want to go up and fix them, they just left them there. So now they can't get rid of them. They're like just sitting there like they're from another planet. So that's one stupid thing. And then, you know, over the years, I always talked about like wood-burning stoves. And, you know, when they talk about like your gas stove, instead of like saying you can have a proper vent to ventilate or open a window, they start scaring the heck out of people. And anyone who cooks knows that you can cook better with a gas light versus whatever. And I said that the day's going to come, folks, in Maine and New Hampshire in the fall when you're wearing that flannel shirt and jeans or dungaree, whatever you want to call them, and you want to make a fire, a wood fire in your wood stove or your fireplace, they're going to knock on your... I mean, you can't burn wood.
Correct. You cut down a tree, even though it fell. All the trees that fell this past weekend, nope.
I mean, this again, there's no rational discussion. It's just an emotional political agenda. What about electric vehicles? You know how the major manufacturers were really increasing this, and all of a sudden people realize we can't afford them? I didn't know the battery cost $30,000, and I'm going to stick with my Ford F-150 with low emissions. So the manufacturers scale back, and they want to ram it down our throats still.
Absolutely. Ask a tow truck driver why they won't tow an electric vehicle these days.
Why? I don't know.
It catches on fire. It burns so hot, Jack, that if you try to put water on it, it evaporates the water. It disintegrates the chemicals.
And you know what's stupid about this? The toxicity of the electric batteries is worse than anything that our manufacturers are making with the low emissions.
And with this 2021 energy code, they want to take and have you upgrade your electric panel up to 400 amps. We already have a capacity issue now. And put it in your garage just in case. And then if you do,
Jack, you know what I love? It's like, Matt, you got me going. And I want you to end on the bill, the final word to lawmakers, yeah. Matt Mabry and the home builder side. Matt, I love folks that will drive around and they'll wave all these international flags, but they won't wave the Support Your Police and Fire or American flag on their porch. So I won't go into details. You get the picture.
Oh, John Kerry flying in his private jet any minute now to tell us how he can save the planet for us.
Yeah, but the other one is they're driving around in their electric vehicles that cost $120,000 because they can, and they look at you sideways if you're driving like a gas-powered SUV, and they'll plug it in some public place, and they're driving the electric vehicle because it feels good to them. And you don't want to ask, do you know some 9-year-old kid in the Congo is being forced to go down to get the lithium and cobalt for your EV? Yeah. How does that make you feel? And they look at you like, what are you talking about? And then they'll start bad-mouthing you. Are you a Trump person? Because they're just so stupid, they can't have a rational discussion. And I go, do you know in China how much, do you know, by the way, if climate change is global, do you know how much pollution that electric battery causes in places like China where they don't care? But isn't that the same atmosphere up above? You can't have a rational discussion because it's like, they just think that they're holier than thou.
How about we hold India and China to half of the standards that we have to live with here in New Hampshire? Just half. That's all I want.
Okay, Matt, the bill today, Matt.
Is Bill 1059. It's the Building and Energy Codes. There'll be an amendment to go to the 2021 Energy Code. Please say no. Do no harm. Stick with the 2018 codes. Please.
Let us know how it goes, okay?
I sure will, Jack. Thank you so much.
I'll stay on it.
Thank you.
Because we can always get Bradley and others on some Monday. Okay, thank you.
Oh, yeah. That'd be great.
Lucas Meyer, one of our great political analysts and all-star strategist advisor on the Democrat side, straight to the dome. And Lucas, plenty to talk about because I think it was kind of unexpected. Ann Custer in your party, who's held and really owned that seat, although it's not her seat, we know that. But you know what I'm saying? Each election... winning since Charlie Bass announcing she's not going to run again, she's out, gives time for people to put their name on the ballot, maybe even yours.
Hard pass on that last part. But
well, wait a minute. Can you confirm or deny? Because the rumor mills have been.
That's a hard no.
Okay, so you took yourself out of the running that easy. But Colin Van Ostern, I'm hearing Republican names. Lily Tang Williams is on yesterday, maybe Dr. Vikram Manchuramani, who ran for the Senate. So it does open somewhat of the unexpected floodgates.
Yeah, and I mean, Congresswoman Custer has had a prolific career in Congress. You know, people forget about that 2010 race she had against Charlie Bass and that 2012 race. CD2 was part of that frontline battleground map. And then Congresswoman Custer, through running really strong races and doing a really good job down in D.C., to your point, really was able to put a hold on that seat. And we talked a lot during the redistricting process that Republicans kept saying, well, look, Democrats keep winning these seats. How can they be fair? If you look at the numbers, these are competitive seats when they open up. So, you know, I think there is a sort of attitude that this is Democrats' seat to lose. I think that's right in so much that Democrats have the seat right now. Congresswoman Custer's announcement certainly was a surprise, I think, to everyone. I certainly wasn't on my radar, but, you know, she doesn't know anyone anything. She's done an amazing work for the state. And so looking ahead, I would expect a really big primary on both sides because of the competitive nature of this district.
You think there will be? Because one of our analysts this morning, it might have been Michael Denny, he said Andrew Walensky, the former executive counselor, he might be looking at it. So you think there will be a primary on the Democrats as well, possibly?
Oh, yeah. Oh, big. I think there will be a lot of people jumping in. I mean, this is going to be very appealing to a number of folks. Now, who ultimately ends up filing to run for office, who knows? But I think for the next month, there'll be a lot of folks who will test the waters. I do not think there will be anyone who comes in as sort of a haymaker, clear the field candidate. I'd like to see a primary. I'd like to see the conversation happen. I think it's an uphill battle for Republicans in that race, in part because I have no reason to believe that with Donald Trump on the ballot, with a Republican primary for the governor's race, I think it'll push the electorate to the right. How far a candidate tacks in that primary might dictate how successful they'll be in the general. So I would expect to see, you know, four or five candidates in the Democratic primary, maybe, at least at the start. Which I think would be good. I mean, let's have a conversation. Let's talk about it. It was certainly a surprise to me.
Lucas, help me out here because you know more on this side or more on this than me on this. But let's stay with this for a moment because we have time. I look at the Democrat side, and one of our analysts yesterday said something interesting that through Shaheen and Hassan, the Democrat State Party, maybe Ray Buckley, have been able to kind of field Democrat candidates who were not kind of in that Bernie Sanders far left side of the plank. I don't know if you'd agree with that or not. And Ann Custer, and I knew her late mom, you know, long time respected, and you got to give her kudos for her ability to hold that seat. But I think in Washington, she might have had more of a progressive left side than the perception here in New Hampshire. That's just my observation. She was popular at home and maybe voted a little more progressive than her district, unless the district is more left. My point is, though, I'm trying to understand this. The last few primaries that we had, of course, this last one, Joe Biden wasn't on the ballot. It was a write-in. Bernie Sanders won the primary. And if Walensky gets in this, I would say Colin Van Ostern sort of fits that John Lynch, Maggie Hassan, Shaheen Lane. Walensky might be a little more of a liberal firebrand. Is that fair or not?
Well, I think that's a fair assessment. I think there'll be more candidates than that. I think we get back to redistricting, we get back to the nature of these districts. I think a smart candidate, you know, you want to build the broadest coalition as possible. I think you can do that being authentic to what your message is. So I'm not sure if like these traditional lines exist anymore. But in a primary with, you know, again, the Democrats have a primary for governor too. So there'll be a lot of activity happening in those races. And so I don't know how those lines will get drawn, but I also imagine this conversation in this race is going to be like predominantly about one thing, which is stopping a federal abortion ban. And like that will be a big part of the conversation.
Let's stay with the inside nitty gritty stuff. Lucas Meyer, straight to the dome. Here's one for you, Lucas. And I got to warn you, it's not a fastball. It's a little bit of a curveball. You ready?
Yeah.
I'm not going to ask you about your own possible running. I'm just having some fun, but I do think that day is coming. But here's one for you, Lucas. Cindy Warmington arguably has been running now for some time for governor, executive council, very respected. I've heard through the grapevine of politics that if that second seat were ever open, that's something she would have coveted running for. But now she's running for governor. We know that. And Joyce Craig. What are the chances now, because I guess anything's possible, Warmington announces she's going to suspend her gubernatorial campaign and run for second congressional district as a Democrat?
She certainly could. I think operationally it's not ideal, in part because the money that Councilor Warmington has raised for her state race, for governor, won't translate into a federal race.
It won't or would?
Would not.
Okay, but on the same time, they've been splitting support. The inside track is Jean Shaheen, when I asked her a few weeks ago, not officially kind of wink-wink, Bill Shaheen, her husband, endorsing, supporting Warmington. But, you know, there's only so many Democrat deep pockets, and Warmington's calling, Craig is calling. If she were to step aside, it gives Joyce Craig the solo lane, and maybe she gets more support in a second congressional run because it's easier for a Democrat like Shaheen or Hassan to say yes to both.
I mean, these are the fun shadow games that you can kind of play out in politics. I think that's like certainly a possibility. I would be somewhat. I don't think I'd bet on Councillor Warmington jumping out of the governor's race to jump into the congressional race. I think if we, you know, get in a time machine and live in a different reality, and this Congresswoman Custer announces her retirement a year ago, maybe that is exactly what happens. But, you know, politics is a game of timing and of chance, and so you have to play with the deck you're dealt. And so I would be very surprised to see Councillor Warmington jump into the congressional race, but also would go into that race as a very strong candidate if she wanted to.
J-Dog, you know that a lot of our analysts, J-Dog, go on to become office holders or run. So, J-Dog, you love the movie Paul Newman, Cool Hand Luke, right? Good movie, right? Classic. So that could be Lucas's marketing, Cool Hand Luke, 2nd District, CoolHandLuke.com. What do you think? You don't like it?
Cool Hand Luke. No, I don't think that was. I don't think many people who go back to like my sports career, if they looked at like how I played, I don't know if Cool Hand Luke would jive with how.
What else is catching your eye?
Man, I'll tell you what, that congressional news took up a lot of oxygen. I think
State House stuff, any bills stuff. Matt Mayberry was just talking about a green energy bill.
We have some really big housing votes today. We have an accessory dwelling unit bill, which would allow more of those ADUs to be built in communities in New Hampshire. I think, again, you look at the housing crisis in the state, how expensive it is to rent. We need to be finding ways to let folks build these ADUs on their property. This is pretty common sense. This happens in a lot of communities in New Hampshire already. We got to make that more prevalent, especially as folks are getting older or folks with disabilities, having that ADU option to have another caretaker, someone in your family living on the same property as you. This hopefully is something that we can advance through. It came out with a bipartisan vote out of a committee, hoping on the floor today to see the same thing, another housing bill dealing with parking requirements. This can really stifle a lot of housing development with having pretty unnecessary, excessive parking requirements for building. Again, bipartisan bill. Hopefully that comes out of the House with a good positive vote so we can send it over to the Senate and keep momentum going, because everyone agrees housing is ridiculous in New Hampshire, and the legislature has a chance today to say, hey, we hear you. We want to make progress on it. So that's what I'm looking for today, which would be it'd be exciting to see some bipartisan consensus on tackling the housing crisis. But, you know, it's the New Hampshire legislature, so it depends on who shows up today. So I haven't gotten a readout yet on what attendance looks like. But fingers crossed for that, especially for folks who are looking to start renting, buying soon. We need to build some more houses in this state. So fingers crossed.
All right. Thank you, Lucas. Lucas Meyer, straight to the dome. Thank you, Lucas.
Thank you, Jack.
Rory O'Neill is NBC News Radio national correspondent. Take it away, Rory.
Yeah, Jack, because after Disney stood up in opposition of that legislation, then the DeSantis and the legislature both worked to strip that special government that had been created by Walt Disney and the then leadership of Florida more than 50 years ago. But just before that government was dissolved, Disney put in a poison pill, essentially putting handcuffs on any future governing body. Well, the agreement that was announced yesterday essentially goes back to the way things were a little bit, but it does put a lot more power in the hands of the governor, who now can appoint all the members of this governing body. There used to be Disney appointees. Now they're gubernatorial appointees. But now that some of the new members, the new faces on the board now, a bit more Disney friendly than they used to be.
You know, it's interesting, Rory, because I was going to ask, because other than a lot of lawyers, I mean, lawyers making a lot of money, is there a winner here? And it sounds like there's a slight perception that it's probably a DeSantis win versus Disney, and they just wanted to settle. I don't know if that's fair or not. Would you say that's fair?
I would say DeSantis is going to, you know, make more noise about this. Disney just wants this to go away and go back to their old way of manipulating Tallahassee quietly through lobbyists and not be so showy about it. And I think Disney's saying, hey, look, we're in this long term. DeSantis has 2 years left. We're just going to ride this out and buy off the next one, essentially.
Yeah, but, you know, it's interesting what DeSantis did with that part of the state university system in Sarasota. taking on the college side, taking on this. I mean, you know, he kind of, some would argue, too much. It might have cost him on the presidential side of things. So I don't think that was it. He certainly has taken a lot of that culture on. Hey, switching gears, J-Dog was mentioning, and we could ask you, we had a ABC News hit at the top of the show about, what did you say, J-Dog, spring training and the flights today? I'm sorry, spring break. What am I? I'm thinking baseball. Spring break, big spring break stuff. That's been in the news, too. Any update on that down in Florida, Roy?
Yeah, it went very well in South Florida. They're all patting themselves on the back for the police crackdown, although I think Mother Nature probably deserves most of the credit. We had some Saturday night rainstorms both Saturdays when things were going to get most active, and that probably kept a lot of the trouble down. And to be I said this before, the troublemakers aren't the ones flying down from Boston College. The troublemakers are actually the ones already in South Florida who head to the beach areas to, you know, enjoy their own spring break. But they're the ones who cause more of the trouble than the actual touristy spring breakers. They're just drinking out of beer funnels. That's no big deal. But some of the other ones are more trouble.
Thank you, Rory. Rory O'Neill, NBC News. Thank you, Rory.
Thanks, Jack.
Neil Levesque, Executive Director, Institute of Politics, St. Hayes. Neil, good morning. They don't make him like that anymore, Joe Lieberman.
No, they don't. You know, he's in some ways he was sort of the Democratic John McCain, and in fact he endorsed John McCain and spoke at the Republican convention after being the vice presidential nominee in 2000. A real class act. I think even if you disagree with him, I think most people really liked him. He came to the New Hampshire Institute of Politics just maybe 2 months ago, 3 months ago. And I'll never forget, I bring him into the
green
room.
Yeah, he was on with us. Yeah.
Yeah, I brought him into the green room. Now, St. Anselm College, of course, is named after St. Anselm. And not a lot of people know much about St. Anselm, including me. But he started asking me all these questions about St. Anselm, and basically, it's almost like he had read five books on the subject of St. Mm-hmm. Anselm mm-hmm. and knew all about it. And, of course, Joe Lieberman was Jewish, so, I mean, you know, a Catholic saint, he's talking about him. He just knew a lot about different things and was really interesting and very, very personable.
Yeah, nice person. Nice person. All right, Neil, you spent a lot of years with Charlie Bass, the last Republican I can check that held that second congressional seat through 2012. And Custer, been in there since, you know, six terms, if I have it right, or close to it, and not running again as a Democrat. One would argue she would have gotten reelected quite easily. She seemed to have that down, raising money and getting reelected in the second district. Are you surprised she's not running, and does it open the floodgates?
Well, I think a lot of people are surprised because we're two months away from the filing period, so that gives people who have name recognition or some sort of ability to raise money a little bit of an advantage. But certainly it was a little bit of a surprise. And that district has more people who are registered Democrats than are registered Republicans. So it gives Democrats an advantage. And if you're going to win that district, you've either got to really motivate your base and keep the other side at home, which doesn't happen these days, or you've got to be able to get, if you're a Republican, get Democrats to vote for you and likewise the other way. But Charlie Bass was able to do that time and time again because he appealed to a wider swath than just the base Republicans, and he was able to win in that district. And since then, the Republican candidate really hasn't gotten more than about 44% of the vote. And so a lot of people believe that whoever wins this Democratic nomination will probably be the congressperson from that district. A big, big district, by the way. So, you know, you take the three streets of Nashua and compare them to Hanover, New Hampshire, or Keene, and it goes all the way up to Pittsburgh, New Hampshire.
Right.
So it's a lot of miles on the car.
I think of Chuck Douglas, Charlie Bass, but I also think of more Democrats than not. Is it the nature of the second district? And can a Republican, no matter who the nominee is, if it's a Colin Van Arsten, if it's Andrew Walensky, can they win going into this fall that second congressional district? Is it winnable for a Republican these days?
I think it's much more difficult than it used to be, and there are factors, some redistricting, but mainly because I think that a lot of the rural Yankee Republican areas of New Hampshire have now turned blue for multiple reasons. I also think that it's a district that the abortion issue on the pro-choice side is to the advantage, as well as the fact that people are much more partisan than they were, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. And, you know, people will go to the polls and just vote their party, and they don't really switch as much. And I think it's very tribal situation. And so I think that it's the Democratic, it's the Democrats really, I think, to lose, you know, if you just look at the paper. But candidate quality matters. And if you had a candidate that could appeal to a wider swath, but, you know, the thing is that parties don't choose that. You know, party voters go in and they choose usually the person that, you know, is grinding an axe or, you know, is right or, you know, 100% pure. And they don't really take into consideration who can win a general election. And that's why a lot of candidates lose. I mean, we don't have a lot of competitive seats in America. And one of the reasons is that, you know, the parties choose these candidates that can't, you know, that are pure. Look at Massachusetts. The conservative right were the people that wanted to get rid of the former governor, and they got rid of him. And now they have, mm-hmm. Basically when you cross the border, it's a yeah. blue state for sure.
What names are you hearing that might look at this Custer opening? I'm hearing Colin Van Ostern, no stranger to Democrats, maybe Andrew Valinsky, former executive counselor. We had Lily Tang Williams in the show yesterday, Republican already running before this. And Dr. Vikram Manchurmani maybe making some calls, people talking to him. And there'll probably be others. Who else you see? What about Neil Levesque? You jumping in?
It's a long commute. Bob Burns ran last time, and I'm sure that he is looking at this race as well. He is a Trump supporter. And he got about 44%, if I'm my memory serves me right, in the last time that he ran. And I would keep an eye on Becky Whitley, who is a Democrat, but she's been fighting the sort of fights on the front lines for Democrats at the New Hampshire State House for years, including since Roe versus Wade was struck down. Mm-hmm. She's really been the champion. She's a very eloquent, very talented candidate. So I would kind of keep my eye on her as well. And as you mentioned, Vikram, who ran for the U.S. Senate, and he's pretty well liked by a large swath of folks across the state. He's been in these races, and he's contributed to a lot of Republican activity. So I think that he's somebody to watch as well.
All right. Anything else catching your eye? What do you make of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s VP selection choice? I do find it interesting because he also was a recent visitor to your Institute of Politics. Democrats don't want him on any ballots. National media doesn't want to cover him. But yet his running mate has deep pockets that can write checks. Does he get, for example, on the New Hampshire ballot this next fall?
I don't think. I'm not sure. I'm sure he'll probably be on the ballot, but I think the vice presidential pick is indicative of the campaign, which is poor. I mean, come on. When people are like, who the hell is that? I mean, when you're going to run as a third party person, you got to be making the
Neil,
three pointers over and over again.
Neil, money talks. You know that. And it takes money to get signatures. I mean, look at the Super Bowl added. Didn't she fund that through the Super PAC? I'm just saying, I'm looking at that Ross Perot year, and I'd have to tell you, Kennedy's more known in more households and independent voters in New Hampshire than Perot was at the time. And some would argue, I think Perot got under 20%, but he did have an impact in Bill Clinton becoming president and George Bush Sr. being a one-term president.
He had an impact, and that's probably why Robert Kennedy was attacked by Donald Trump the other day, because I think maybe Trump is figuring out that maybe he's taking votes from him. You're right that money matters in politics, but it also, the vice presidential pick is sort of like who, it's very indicative of how serious your campaign is.
But you and I know that, I tell you, there, I always laugh when people like you and me and all the analysts and pundits will talk about the VP pick. And, of course, Trump has played that marketing game, floating names. Was it Tim Scott of South Carolina? He hasn't chosen yet, as far as I know. Biden's with Vice President Harris. She had been a candidate running, as you remember. And speaking of Joe Lieberman, very appropriate, Neil. We have some time. Lieberman. On the VP ticket side. So everyone always makes a big deal of that. And you and I know, in the end, people vote for the top of the ticket, not the number two. You and I know that. But it makes for good discussion. But sometimes there's a strategy, and people don't know their history well enough. You do. But John F. Kennedy, speaking of Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., JFK picked Lyndon Baines, LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, powerful Southern politician, Kennedy Northeast. Strange bedfellows, worked, even though they, I heard they despised each other. Pick, you know, needed a Southern, you know, politician to get to win the, you know, win the election. What about President Obama? Who did he pick, class? Joe Biden. And why was that? Well, Obama was younger, and people perceived he wasn't strong on foreign policy, if I remember at the time. And Biden was sitting on a lot of the committees, and he was very respected, older, maybe foreign policy wiser. So, you know, it worked for a couple terms. So I always laugh. I don't laugh, but the VP thing is overrated. But once in a while, it's very strategic and works. Some would say John McCain stumbled there. Some would say others. But I actually think on the Trump side, let's take a moment before I let you go. You know, it's Biden-Harris, whether or not Kennedy has traction and getting on ballots. Who does Trump end up picking if you had to say? I know he's unpredictable, but if you had to say, Neil.
Well, I think he's smart to go with Tim Scott because he's a legitimate, good pick, and I think that he adds to the ticket. Now, my feeling on the Robert Kennedy thing is when you pick somebody and one says, why did they get picked? Well, she's got money. And by the way, the biggest thing that everyone said when he made this pick yesterday was, who? I mean, no one's even heard of this person. She has no qualifications to be president of the United States.
However, she has a big I hate to argue.
Give me a break.
But I hate to argue.
It's a joke. The whole thing is a joke.
I don't fully agree, and I'll tell you why. When you have billions of dollars, and this is what you want to do with her, Shanna, you know, the ex-wife of a Google founder, and she's got all this money, and they start running ads in states to get signatures, all of a sudden, it doesn't matter who she is. They're talking. They're seeing Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And you know who he is. Whether you know anything about him or not, you know the name.
I just think that this woman, everyone got. I mean, I honestly, if you ask me what her name is right now, I couldn't.
Isn't it his last name? I think it's Shanahan. But you know the other thing.
I mean, both of us don't even know, and this is what we do for work.
But it doesn't matter. I'm telling you, it doesn't matter. It immediately, it immediately makes
for president of the United States.
No, Neil, I love to go with you. It immediately makes Kennedy's pack and his chance to get on ballots solvent and profitable. It immediately doesn't matter. I mean, if he went after a big namesake, and he got Chris Christie or someone. You know, or some, I don't, you know, some political, I don't think it would have done him any good. I think he picked smart because of money. I know that you don't agree with me, but I got to tell you, if this race is that tight between Biden and Trump, and I happen to think it is, I think it's going to be a very close race. Kennedy can play a spoiler role by just showing up on certain ballots, and I don't know where it cuts from, but I would not write this off as an insignificant event. I'm just my gut. I may be wrong.
He would have played a better spoiler role if he had picked a vice president who people would say, boy, that was a smart pick because that person could easily be the president of the United States.
Who would you have recommended? Because I think most people know Kennedy is not going to win no matter what. So he's doing this for a reason. But who would you say would have made him?
Well, you have to. But if you're going to cast
like a Tulsi, Tulsi Gabbard,
the United States.
Tulsi Gabbard, like that.
I mean, there. I think there are what I call is the Colin Powell person of the 1990s is where you want to be, where somebody says, "Oh, that was a smart pick," and that person is capable of being president. And John McCain, if he were still alive, God bless him, would have said that his mistake in that was that no one looked at Sarah Palin and thought, "Okay, she tells a great joke about." Pit bulls, but she's not qualified to be president of the United States.
And you know what?
this
I'm telling
serious
you.
Business, people will not give a vote just because somebody is rich doesn't qualify them to be president.
You're the professor, and this is fun because I love to tangle with you. Do you think Vice President Harris would be a good president?
Well, I think when we look at the data, the American people, she has worse numbers than Joe Biden.
Yeah, so is that
and
a good
so
pick?
I think the American people would say that, no, she's not a good pick.
Yeah.
But he picked her.
Yeah. All right, Neil, we're going to run. Thank you, buddy.
She was a U.S. senator, you know, so she had some qualifications there that other than the fact that she had a big checkbook. If you took the checkbook away from this woman, she has, I mean, and...
Okay, you and I are going to choose not to agree.
Marry for the money.
You and I choose not to agree, but I choose to agree, not to agree, to agree, whatever. Thank you, Neil.
Thanks, Jack.
Neil Levesque, Institute of Politics, St. Nelson College.